Okay.
Thank you.
And here's one of
the boys.
Good.
I don't want
to. I literally told him he was coming in the door.
You go white.
I tried to tell him we didn't want. He goes, oh, we're moving it. So I go, okay.
What are we moving?
The task force bill.
Okay, fine.
Not today.
Welcome, everybody, to the Senate Committee on Business and Transportation. For the record, it's March 27th, 2017. Got a number of bills to hear today, and we're going to start off with...
930.
Which one?
Senate Bill 9.
Yeah, but if we don't move...
We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 930. Patrick?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 930 allows registered owners of vehicles to blackout or obscure the residence address, business address, mailing address, or vehicle address shown on the registration card and on proof of insurance or other current proof of compliance. This measure has no amendment before us. We do not currently have fiscal revenue impact statements on the measure, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Patrick. Senator Przanski, welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, committee members, for giving me an opportunity to give you testimony on Senate Bill 930. My name is Floyd Przanski, State Senator, District 4, which includes parts of Lane and Douglas counties. The reason I brought forward Senate Bill 930 is I think it's time for us to actually put something in the statute that is currently in rule. This is to ensure that individuals that are driving motor vehicles understand that they have the authority to actually block out on the registration form their addresses. And the reason for that, I believe, was posted today out of my office, was an article that was in the Register Guard back on January 5th of this year. Entitled EPD Warrants Keep Garage Door Remote Control Car Registration Away from Thieves. Specifically, what's happening is that as most of us, we keep our registration forms within our vehicles. So if we're pulled over and we're driving and the officer asks for your title, registration, and insurance, you're able to actually pull that out of your glove box and show it to them as required. Unfortunately, the suggestion from EPD, Eugene Police Department, was that maybe you should carry this on your person at all times instead of leaving it in your vehicle. Well, as most of us know, if you have more than one family member that drives, you may be driving the same vehicle on different days at different times or even on the same day. And how do you make certain the registration's with the right person? So in drafting this up, I asked for DMV and the Department of Transportation to actually look at it and get their feedback, and they basically came back with a brilliant suggestion. Well, you can already block it out, and it's actually in the rules. But I, as a prosecutor, have never known that. I've always have taken the position as an individual driver, you need to have that available. And I've always have seen, from my perspective, the inconsistency of where you could have someone's car being vandalized, someone going in there and taking whatever they can get of value. And ironically, if they actually get your garage door opener, if you keep that in the vehicle, which most people do, and they get your registration, guess what? They now know where you live. They know how to get in the garage. And unfortunately, many people who have a garage that's attached to their house, they don't lock the other door. And lo and behold, not only did you just get your car either stolen, rifled through, you've now been burglarized. And so I'm asking this committee to consider making this a law so it can actually be better published and better understood by the general public that they do, in fact, have the ability to block out their addresses that are on the registration form. I did speak to DMV. I hope they may be here too, but my understanding, they said this had no fiscal impact, which I was very pleased because it basically is something that is already provided for by rule.
Well, I mean, you're taking away all the inconvenience. If you had all of that, they could just pull into the garage, close the door, and just without disturbing your neighbors, fill up the car.
My understanding that has happened on more than one occasion.
Okay.
One-stop shop.
Any question to the senator?
Yeah. Yes.
Go ahead,
Senator. Floyd. Amy's back there, so we will get to hear from her.
All right.
Is there anybody in opposition to this? It seems like such a no-nonsense.
Mr. Chair, Senator,
just a quick question.
I'm not sure of anyone being in opposition. No one's come to me. This is one of those situations, coming from my birth state of Texas and having here where you actually have to maintain your registration in your vehicle, I always found it peculiar that you'd have that type of identifying information on it. And then having, of course, unfortunately now alerts going out as PSAs in the greater Eugene Springfield area. A warning and alerting people that they shouldn't be keeping those in your vehicle where you
have
access to them.
That'd be very disappointing to the law enforcement officer when they stop you and say, license and registration, and say, I'm sorry, but it's at home.
Right. Oh, it's on the other pair of jeans.
It's a different jean. Amy, is there a reason, if the rule says you can black it out, why don't we just change the requirements and just take it off the registration?
Chair Beyer, Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation. With all things DMV under our current system, it would probably cost some money to make that change, to remove that. And so I think Senator Przanski identified a completely free way to get this done. In our new system, in a couple of years, we might be able to do that for next to nothing. But right now, it's going to cost something, and we know what that means
in the building. Costs us money to leave something off.
And if I could, Mr. Chair, we were actually looking at taking it off that requirement, but it was impressed upon me, and it's unfortunate because of the outdatedness of the computer system that we do have for DMV, and I've seen ODOT to some level, but at least DMV. It seems like this might be a better alternative at the time.
Yeah, we've heard this song before. Okay, thank you both.
Thank you.
That's all. Is anybody else who wanted to test?
I actually got a question for you.
Oh, sorry.
Did you talk with OSP to find out what their position on this was?
Mr. Chair, Senator Girard, no, I have not spoken to OSP directly. But I would say that since we already provide for it and rule that it can be done, this is just basically elevating it out of a rule into law.
Well, they can get, through their computer system, they can get the address.
They will.
In fact, by the time they walk up to the car, they already have the address.
Mr. Chair, Senator Girard, it's very, very routine that an officer, trooper, or deputy is going to actually ask for the registered owner information, and they'll have all that. In prosecution, you have access to all that. So they will continue to have access. It's just that you will, on the physical form, it will not necessarily be written there that you or I could look at and read it.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there anybody else who wished to testify? Seeing none, we will close the public hearing. We will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 989.
Yeah, we can take his testimony really quick.
We'll get right to you next.
Okay.
I've got a bunch of legislators I'm trying to get back to work, so we'll let them in.
We'll take his testimony and come back.
You ready?
You're on.
I am, for the record, I'm Brian Boquist, State Senator from District 12, and I actually started out in the bill that's before you, which is to develop a transition plan to move all of our rest areas that are presently in the state and under state control over the Travel Information Council. Having said that now, as the co-vice chair of the Joint Transportation Preservation and something else committee, whatever that long thing is, Patrick knows the name, I just call it transportation. Anyway, in one of the discussions, multiple discussions we've had there, we're trying to look at the rest areas that we have now and develop a long-term plan so that the public, as we develop a long-term transportation plan, actually sees immediate improvements in the transportation infrastructure that we have in the state. I think most of you will know that, unfortunately, due to various reasons across the state, we have transitioned out of some of our flowing water rest areas and have moved into holes in the ground, especially out in your district, by the way, Senator Thompson. And the goal here that Travel Information Council and the Department of Transportation and State Parks are working on. They're going to give you testimony a little bit later. They haven't finalized a plan of how to do it, but they're working down that line to have this session a plan that we can adopt so that we'll know and be able to tell the public that we are going to improve our rest areas, the experience is going to improve, and our roadways are going to improve. It's actually a very simple bill, but quite complicated. I would give you a few other vernaculars of what it will do, but since you all have been in the rest area that just has a hole, you know exactly what I'm talking about.
Any questions to the senator? Thank you, Senator. We're going to recess on 989, and we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 867. And Patrick, and come on down.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 867. Creates a task force on maritime sector workforce development. I'll just leave it at that so I don't steal the thunder. I will say, however, that we have received a -1 amendment. That's from Representative Gomberg. It deletes the reference to enterprises engaged in offshore oil and gas exploration from the definition of maritime sector. Mr. Chair, we do not currently have fiscal revenue impact statements for this bill either.
Senator Roblin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Arne Roblin, State Senator from District 5, which goes from Coos Bay to Tillamook Bay and then into Sheridan and Falls City in the Valley. This bill came out of a grassroots effort up and down the coast, but in particular in Lincoln County in Newport. Washington State decided that they wanted to look at the different sectors in their state, and they decided to start a maritime sector, and that turned out to be one of the largest sectors in their state, previously unknown as a sector itself. So we have agriculture. We've got a bunch of other sectors that we work with in our state. And what we're saying is we believe that if we took some time to actually look at the maritime sector, whether it's the barging that we do, whether it's the ships that we build, whether it's the fishing fleet, all of those things that are part of the maritime sector, we could make a case for it being one of the major sectors of economic development in our state, and that then money could follow some of the training requirements. If you're going to hear from Clatsop Community College, which does have a maritime one, you've got a community college in Newport that deals with aquarium science and some other kinds of things. We would really like to have us investigate at the state level and come up with defining what a maritime sector would look like, because we believe it is one of the big drivers. One of the other aspects you'll hear about is that we have a number of people. Clatsop Community College is a good example. They train people for this industry. They end up heading off to Florida, heading off to the Gulf states and doing work, but they keep their resident in Oregon. So we don't count them as part of our workforce. They pay taxes. They do other kinds of things here. The Merchant Marine, those people go all over the world. Many of them live in Oregon. We don't count them as part of our workforce because we don't have a maritime industry. So there's a whole lot of unreported people out there who think of Oregon as their home, who work all around the world in this industry. And we would like to make sure that we start having a conversation about what that industry is, what it takes to become a member of that industry. It's a very high-paying jobs in that industry. And so our goal is to try to step up and have a conversation in the state about who, what, and who should be included in that maritime industry, and then come back to this august body and try to figure out how we put that into the economic development of Oregon.
Welcome, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For your record, David Gomberg from House District 10 on the Central Oregon coast, and I appreciate the remarks that Senator Roblin has shared with you. He's absolutely on point. This did grow out of a grassroots effort and several task force meetings that were coordinated by Commissioner Hunt from Lincoln County. Commissioner Hunt could not be with us today, but sends his regards. I just wanted to highlight the fact that this is a bipartisan, bicameral bill that is sponsored in large part by the members of the Coastal Caucus. I'm not going to go into a lot of details for you, Mr. Chairman, because there is a large, a knowledgeable, and a particularly good-looking group of people from my district that are here today, and they're going to speak in more detail for you. But certainly the maritime industry is something well worth our consideration. Our challenge on the coast, just as the challenge around the entire state of Oregon, is not simply to create more jobs, but to create better jobs, and this is the way we do it.
So, Representative, let me see if I get this straight. This bill to create a maritime task force study group comes to us on recommendation from a task force?
Our own. A local one.
Okay. Representative.
Chair Beyer, Vice Chair Thompson, David Brock Smith, State Representative, House District 1, Charleston to Brookings, along the coast over to West Cape Junction and up to West Roseburg. I just want to agree with my two colleagues. We have a bet to see who testimony will be shortest, so I will plan on winning that bet. And just to let you know that my district and our ports are a crucial economic driver. In fact, in Port Orford, which was just in the Oregonian as the 13th most impoverished city in the state, if I remember correctly, the article correctly, has 35% of its economy comes from the port of Port Orford. This bill is long overdue, and it's a good bill, and it should pass.
Senator.
First of all, I agree that we're underutilizing our ports. The problem is task force and funding task force right now is really difficult. Can't we just do this as a work group?
As long as we can get the full support of our wonderful legislator colleagues in the future when we come back to ask for it to truly be organized in that way from when the state, I think we might be able to do some of that. But we believe that the best way to get there is to have an authorized task force that can do it. We don't need a whole lot of money to run our task force. We have a lot of people who are willing to put their time and effort in, but finally making those difficult decisions as to what's in and what's out, this conversation needs to be focused, and I think the task force is the best way to focus it.
Any other questions? Thank you, gentlemen. We'll let you get back to work.
Thank you very much.
All righty. The first panel I've got up here is Commissioner Thompson, Rick Williams, and Bud Shoemaker. Shoemaker?
You bet.
You betcha. Welcome.
Thank you. I'll do a little of the introduction. I'm Terry Thompson, ex-legislator, county commissioner. In reality, I'm a fisherman. And that's been always my passion. So this started from Betsy Johnson, believe it or not. We had a conversation when we started to build the OSU Marine Science Center, the new 500-student campus that we funded that we're developing. But I promised her that I would try to develop a coast-wide program so the whole coast would be advantaged. And I started a work group with the community colleges. As I got into it, I found out that they had no money for the workforce training in the maritime industry. And so that was the first group. This is actually a combination of second group because Doug Hunt was down at Senator Arne Roblin's Coastal Economic Summit. And he found out that we were having a similar problem with a whole marine industry. So we combined the two groups. Doug became the chair. And they've met and worked on it over the time. One of the, to answer your question, I believe AOC is going to be the person that staffs and pays for the group, so it doesn't have to come from the state funds, because I know this time it's state funds. But the important thing is we have state recognition. So what I'm going to do now is just turn this over to the people who've been working on it. Rick Williams is a submarine captain, and we've worked, I guess, 6 or 7 years talked about this issue. Maritime industry understands there's a problem here. Our problem is to make it so that the agencies and the state all come together and really come up with the right answers and solutions.
Thank you, Commissioner. Members of the committee, Chair Beyer, for the record, my name is Rick Williams. I live in Clackamas County. I'm going to go over 5 points that I provided as written testimony, and I want to head it off first with some word engineering. We define maritime as opposed to marine because marine is typically waterside. Maritime is waterside and upland. And when you know, one of our members from Shaver Transportation pointed out, if you drive on it and if you use it, it probably came by sea at some point. So the 5 points that I want to make is Oregon's maritime economic sector is diverse, vibrant, and productive, and not recognized. It's not acknowledged as a source of high-wage, high-availability jobs, and we have provided a set of slides to the committee on the various clusters, economic clusters, that are in the sector, and they're all traded sector revenue, which is the coin of the realm in business development. My second point is benchmarking. We've benchmarked Washington and California maritime economic sector studies, and we found that they've done a lot of work studying their sectors. They are similar to ours and different from each other. Both Seattle and California, San Diego in particular, where I've driven ships out of both, have a big D defense, and that tilts a lot of what they do to the defense industry, and we don't have that here. San Diego has a large blue tech cluster, which is non-defense and is more related to us. But when you look at the slides that I provided, the number of clusters that we recognize that are in the sector is quite impressive. And then the third point is the Oregon way. Oregon is different from the other two states and worth the study of a task force because of the Columbia Snake River transportation system. We have more clusters of fishing, including our distant waters fleet. Many of us work as career mariners. We pay taxes, and we work out of state. So the Oregon Employment Department and the Workforce Improvement or Workforce Investment Council don't recognize our jobs, nor do they train anybody to take them. I'm looking forward to someone taking my job at some point. The fourth point is to study or to take action. One of the things I hope that the task force will come up with is we have Oregon's Maritime College. They have a wonderful program that both of my sons have graduated from and become credentialed mariners. At the moment, they do not have a certified engineering program, and we need that. I love driving high-performance ships, particularly when they have an operational propulsion system. They're so much more fun when they can maneuver, and you need qualified, certified engineers, and the rules are changing with the Coast Guard. A lot of our fish boats and crab boats are going to need qualified, certified Coast Guard licensed engineers. And then finally, not to hearken back to our history, taxation without representation. We are mariners in the state of Oregon. We pay taxes, and we don't get recognized. The workforce does not get developed to replace us, and we have high-wage, high-availability jobs. And I look forward to a task force or whatever form looking into the sector. And then finally, Oregon's a great place to drive ships from. You don't drive a lot of ships here, but it's a great place to live. It's a great place to raise a family. That's why I retired after 27 years active duty in the Navy, to bring my family home and raise my sons, who are both credentialed mariners and live in the state. I think Oregon tourism could catch up on what we're doing and initiate something like a Home Port Oregon program so we could attract mariners that, hey, this is a great place to call home, raise your family, and we got the best airport in the United States that you can commute through. So in summary, I'm a big supporter of this, and I'll turn it over to my colleague.
All right, thank you. Chairman Beyer, I'm Bud Shoemake. I'm the port manager in Toledo, Oregon, and we're a small port upriver about 12 miles from Newport. We do a lot of the service on the commercial fishing boats, wave energy, and we just did 8 NOAA research boats here the last they're small survey boats this last month. But in Lincoln County, commercial fishing is our number one industry. It's bigger than tourism. It's bigger than timber. And so it's really important to us. Over the last 5 or 6 years, the port purchased a boatyard, and with a whole lot of help from the state, Business Oregon, port planning and marketing, I can't say enough for, we were able to develop that boatyard, and we're in the final stage of putting up a large environmental building. What it means for our is about 167 new jobs. For the last 2 years, I've run ads looking for, on Craigslist and through the employment office, looking for qualified employees. They're hard to find. I just hired a fellow out of Hawaii as a welder. Came over. He's making $30 an hour plus benefits. We've got a local high school that had a welding program up to about 3 years ago, and the program isn't funded. The welders are still up there. Several of those kids that went through that program are welding for Yaquina Boat, which is another leasee of the port. One of our goals, the commission's goals for opening the boatyard, was to try to keep our youth in our county. They aren't staying. They're going elsewhere. And so trying to get the tools to keep our kids here and to keep developing the industry we have. A lot of the boats that we are now able to haul out, we're going either out of state or out of country for their work. Newport is second only to Seattle in the size of its distant water fleet, not necessarily the size of the vessels, but the number of vessels. And they're really important to us. So it's millions of dollars that, and so I think it deserves to be recognized. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Thank you, gentlemen. Let's see. Now I have Bridget Reisling and Bill Emtilla. Please.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Byer. I'm Bill Antilla. I'm the director of the Maritime Science Program at Clatsop Community College. I am a vessel operator. I ran towboats, commercial fishing vessels, cargo vessels, a little bit of everything. At Clatsop, we offer a wide range of training. We offer both continuing education for current mariners, and we offer a training ship program that allows students to enter with no prior experience as fully credentialed mariners. A student graduating as an able-bodied seaman starting out full-time earns around $75,000 a year working 6 months out of the year with full benefits. Many of these people do not work in the state of Oregon, so in effect we create a new job in Oregon's economy every time we send out one of these people, yet they don't go on record as being of any benefit to the state or even existing. On the marine engineering side, there's only one school in the entire west coast of the United States where a student can walk in off the street and enroll in classes, and that happens to be in Alaska. We are currently working at creating and implementing a program to provide both the continuing education and to allow people to advance their professional credentials, and a training ship program that will open a pathway for students to transition directly from high school to employment. Again, these are high-dollar jobs that are in great demand. In trying to create these types of training opportunities, there are many problems to overcome. Some are easy, some are much more difficult. One of the biggest problems we're facing is lack of good information and recognition. A question of what training is needed for employment would seem to be simple enough, but depending on who you ask, the answer varies wildly. When a vessel transits a waterway, it leaves a wake behind it that everyone can see. What we don't see is there's a similar fiscal ripple effect, and the impacts reach far beyond what we might realize. Until we actually understand the nature of these connections, it's hard to understand who the impacted employers are and what types of skills we need to provide a student for them to be employable in all these different workplaces. If we want to maximize the benefits of this sector, we need to understand these types of connections. I strongly urge the support of this. We really need better information. Last meeting, we had someone pull the Oregon employment statistics on masters and pilots. I believe it showed 11 jobs available. I quit counting at 100 when I counted the ones I knew that are working in Oregon in those jobs. Following this is the president of Oregon Coast Community College, Brigitte Reisling.
Hello, thank you. Brigitte Reisling, Oregon Coast Community College in Lincoln County. Thank you for this opportunity to speak in support of Senate Bill 867. Oregon Coast Community College stands ready to further augment the good work that is happening at Clatsop Community College, who has been preparing people to enter the maritime sector workforce. We, the community college leadership, envisions a network of collaborating community colleges working together with high schools, with industry, with pre-apprenticeship and apprenticeship-type programs, and universities to meet the workforce needs of Oregon's maritime sector. In order for this to happen, we need good data and we need coordination. We need to better understand the maritime sector, both what exists today and in Lincoln County for us, ports, boatyards, fisheries, aquariums, research vessels, and also what is emerging, for example, offshore renewable energy, aquaculture, and marine biotechnology, to mention just a few. It is core to the mission of community colleges to serve the workforce needs of the communities that we serve and to advance the regional economy. In order to do so effectively for the maritime sector, we need, as has been pointed out several times, a better understanding of the education and workforce pathways that lead to these good-paying jobs, that jobs that support families while propelling our regional and state economy forward. Along the coast, we've known for a long time that the maritime sector is a vital component to the economic strength of the region. but without current and comprehensive data, it is difficult to understand the infrastructure needs to support the sector. We can look north to Washington State as a model, and that study has been referenced several times. In 2003, they conducted a study, and they determined that Maritime provided in Washington 148,000 jobs with an average salary approaching $71,000 a year. This contributes in Oregon, in Washington, $30 billion a year to their economy. Washington used this data to develop strategic plans to support the maritime sector, and education providers used this data to better align their offerings to the needs of the maritime sector. The community colleges, along with our industry and education partners, look forward to an Oregon maritime industry supported by a well-prepared workforce, strong and rich in the know-how and trade skills. The Task Force on Maritime Sector Workforce Development is a crucial next step for us. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions of this panel? Thank you very much. Mark Landau.
Good afternoon, Chair Beyer, members of the committee. Mark Landauer here on behalf of the Oregon Public Ports Association in support of Senate Bill 867. Just a quick background. Oregon's 23 ports directly, indirectly, and induce over 100,000 jobs in the state of Oregon, according to a 2014 Business Oregon Economic Impact of Oregon Ports. This is a sector that's largely ignored, as previous speakers have spoken, and we would like to be able to engage in this task force. I would note for Senator Girod, Section 3, Sub 12, the AOC will be responsible to staff the task force, and Subsection 15 of the bill simply requires state agencies to assist the AOC with that. And so with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions of Mark?
Thank you, Mark.
Is there anybody else who wishes to speak on this bill? Seeing none, again, we don't have the paperwork, so we're going to close. What do we got here?
This is the next bill.
Okay. We'll close on that. We'll open a work session on Senate Bill 885. Patrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just through my stuff here. Senate Bill 885 reduces from 25 years to 8 years the amount of time an applicant for registration by the State Board of Examiners of Engineering Land Surveying must have held registration or license in another jurisdiction in order for the Board to waive the requirement to take the fundamentals of engineering examination. It also authorizes the Board to also waive the practical engineer's examination for persons if the applicant has held a similar registration license in another jurisdiction for at least 8 years. We have Representative Boone, I think, in the back of the room, is here to speak to this bill.
Representative Boone.
Yeah, I know. It doesn't matter.
Welcome to the committee.
Correct that, too.
You're up, Representative.
This should be a public
hearing. Is this a work session or a public hearing?
It's a public hearing.
885.
Yeah.
You're on.
I thought you said it was a work session.
Public hearing. You did.
Did I say work session?
Yeah,
I
think you public did. Hearing.
I made a mistake on the public hearing.
Is Senator Roblin coming too?
Well, he was here. I don't know where he went.
I'll go ahead and start over.
Okay. But you're here.
So, for the record, good afternoon. My name is Deborah Boone. I represent the beautiful upper left coast of our state, rainy as it is. And I'm here today to, actually, I had a House bill of the same bill that we dropped in reference to the senator being the upper, you know, the upper class. So we're going to go with that one. This bill has been, you've seen it before, maybe a couple years ago. It's a PennWER supported bill, reciprocity for engineering between Canada and the U.S. or and Oregon. And there, you know, we opened this, I think last time when we opened the discussion on it, we made it more focused on resilience and in the case of an emergency. I think this is a little bit broader. And are you looking at, is he behind me? There he is. And so anyway, in deference to my senior colleague here, I will let him, since it's his bill, I covered for you a little bit there.
Yes, I appreciate that.
Backed by popular demand.
We got popular demand in the committee next door, too. For the record, Arnie Roblin, State Senator, District 5, from Coos Bay to Tillamook Bay and into Sheridan Falls City. This bill has been one we've looked at for a number of sessions, and one of these days I'm just going to figure out how to get it so that everybody can agree, because I think the premise behind it is a really important one. We have in North America the opportunity of working with our friends in Canada, and they have the opportunity to work with us. In individual states, they're making decisions. Idaho's done some, and they're all different because they're individual states, on how to do a reciprocity process to have available people. When the oil sands were working really hard, we had a number of electricians that went from Coos Bay to Canada to work in the mines up there, and stuff was worked out to make it easier for people to go back and forth and work in Canada because they needed people, and then come back, send their money back to Coos Bay. This is an idea that is the same kind of thing. It's saying if we have standards that are similar, if we can figure out how to equate those standards, and from my perspective in this bill, we talk about 8 years of experience. You have a chance to look at how the building and the engineering and stuff is happening in Canada, how it is in this country. There are differences, but engineers are trained to understand the different geology below the buildings to make sure that they build it to the right specifications. And I believe that in ways, they are very, very similar. What I would love to have figure out, and I thought this bill was on its way to doing that, is to come up with some kind of reciprocity that works. Debbie's absolutely correct. When we may need this is more in the case of a catastrophic event, when we're trying to rebuild bridges and trying to get other things, and we don't have enough engineers. At that point, it would be really nice if it was already in place. But I think there are reasons for it to happen now, and I know the engineers are not there yet. And I need to sit down at some point and have a long conversation. We had an engineer come from the Canadian province of British Columbia to come down and talk with them. And they can talk a little bit more about that. But the goal here is to try to figure out how do we develop a cadre of engineers who actually can do the work when necessary. And it's not about encroaching in one person's territory or another. It's about figuring out what is equally well, where is the knowledge that they've learned, because we have different systems in a place to qualify engineers. So I like to continue to have the conversation. I will continue it whether this bill passes or not, because I really do think that at some point we have to put in place ways in which expertise can be used a little bit more fully back and forth across our borders. So thank you very much.
Thank you. If I can add to that, an example just for your interest. When I think it was the Hurricane Sandy on the East Coast, they needed electricians, et cetera, and they had already had an agreement on comity or reciprocity set up, so they could just call the states they had agreements with and say, we need engineers here, we need, in this case, electricians to help us get our buildings back so they're inhabitable. And that's one of the biggest things with the resilience plan, that one of the top things the resilience plan keeps pushing for is a way to get people back once things are settled down and we're starting to restore, to get people back in their buildings so business can continue, because it's almost for sure if your business is stopped for over 2 weeks that it may not even start up again for various reasons. But to determine whether buildings, number one, are safe to go back into, they need to be engineered in that sense, or assessed by engineers.
Thank you, Senator.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. The question I have is reciprocity goes two ways. So, I mean, have you been talking with the Canadian government, which I would imagine each province would be
like
different.
State.
It's more than a state, but yeah.
Yeah.
So if you're talking reciprocity, then we have to have a Canadian counterpart. And then have you talked to the Board of Engineering? Or
Our engineer came and talked to the board. That did not go as well. I was hoping we would have amendments or whatever. That did not work out, so we don't have any amendments this time, and I haven't figured out what it is exactly that creates the problem. I'll be listening to the testimony here to find out if that gives me a better insight into that exact question. We agree entirely that there has to be reciprocity, has to go both ways. So their provincial governments have to do the same thing.
And there is a difference, that the difference right now to be determined whether it changes, stays the same, et cetera, is the number of years of experience required by the Canadians is 8 years, and the number required by Oregon is 25 years. So it's quite a disparity in number of years required. So that's an issue with some people. Personally, I just would like to see us come to some sort of agreement on it so that we can share if we need, because, you know, in all reality, if the big one hits, when the big one hits, we're going to lose some of our engineers.
Okay. Senator Riley?
Yeah. The bill in front of us doesn't say anything about Canada. This bill actually includes Russia, Iran, and any other country that you might name. So I have a problem with that kind of broad opening up of this.
I appreciate that. And that was one of the things we would hope we would have gotten if we had a bigger conversation about what the amendment should be. But yes, I'd be glad to entertain that one. And I really do thank you for the conversation, because it will hopefully give me better insights as I listen to testimony as to where to go from here.
Senator?
You know, I was a dentist, and it's kind of similar. And I practiced in Canada, and so, I kind of have a little bit to say about what we do up in there. But I agree that if the schooling is equal or thereabouts, then I agree that we should have some type of reciprocity. It's just hard getting everybody at the table at the same time. And I have to tell you, one province like Alberta, he probably is very pro-American. Another province might not be so easy to work with. So, but that goes back to the board, and the board has to be willing to do that. So we'll be hearing from the board, and we'll see what they have to say.
Right.
Okay. Anything else?
Thank you.
Thank you
very much.
One more time.
My other committee.
Okay. So let's see. Marshall Koba, Aaron Austin, and Paul, is it?
Heidenreich.
Sorry about that.
Good afternoon, Chair Byers and members of the committee. My name is Marshall Koba, representing the American Council of Engineering Companies. We have about 110 Oregon-based firms with 3,000-plus employees. And while we have a great deal of respect for the sponsors of the bill and work well with them on a number of issues, Senator Roblin and Representative Boone, we are here in opposition to Senate Bill 885, but I was pleased to hear we too are open to a continued conversation about this issue. I'm pleased today to have two ACEC members with me today, but I also want to point out to maybe Senator Girard's point, who's not in the room, OSBILS, our regulatory board, is not here. The Oregon State Board of Examiners for Engineering and Land Surveyors, who is the regulatory board that works on this on a regular basis, that would work with foreign engineers or engineers from another state, are not here to offer their expertise, and so we're not going to have that for the discussion today. Interestingly, I had a call this morning from an engineer who gets to Senator Riley's point about this being well beyond Canada. It's global. In some countries, if you have a business license, you can hold out your shingle as an engineer. This guy, for kicks, bought a Bolivian business license, engineering license, for $62 and hangs it on his wall. So he's registered in Bolivia for $62. And so there is great inconsistencies around the globe of a licensure for engineers. So with me today, to turn it over to two experts, Aaron Austin and Paul Heidenreich. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Senator Beyer and the committee members. My name is Aaron Austin. I'm general counsel at David Evans & Associates, which is a multidisciplinary and multi-state engineering company. I've been employed as an attorney in this industry for nearly 20 years, and I'm here to testify in opposition to Senate Bill 885. The licensing of engineers is important to the citizens of Oregon. The public relies on the license of professional engineers to hold paramount the safety, health, and welfare of the public in the performance of their duties. Waiving the two tests, because that's what they're asking to do, is be able to waive the fundamental mathematical exam and the fundamental or the engineering exam. So it's waiving those two exams in lieu of having a certain number of years of experience. I think that it is raises doubt that these objectives can be achieved. So I'm opposed. This is more relevant as a practical manner to people outside the country, even though it's drafted in a manner that is not limited to foreign applicants. It's practically, it is just relevant to the foreign applicants because the process for evaluating U.S. citizens from other U.S. states is really based on the standardized testing program that's available through the National Council of Engineers for Engineering and Surveying. And I checked, and Oregon has been participating in that process since 1965 and 1967 for the PE exam. So it's been an institutionalized process for quite some time. And that's important to understand that these inconsistencies and qualifications really is not a practical issue for most people from the U.S. It becomes an issue from people coming from other countries. The concern that there are not enough engineers in Oregon I question it. I won't say it's not true, but I question it. There are over 5,000 licensed engineers living in Oregon and 7,000 living outside of Oregon State. Oregon already has the authority to, in the case of emergencies, to address concerns for engineering services under the statute. So there's some emergency statutes that give the authority to the governor to modify and allow for prompt or specialized appropriation of services. So there is already a process. We also already have a process for comedy. We already can reciprocal. We have a way of recognizing other people. So this is not a situation which there is no opportunity from people outside of Oregon to become licensed. We already have a process. Again, it's just the testing that they want to take away, which in my mind is important to verify the ability to meet those requirements. The other difference is that Oregon actually licenses individual by specialty. So if you're coming from another country that has no particular test or no particular expertise that's recognized, without the testing, we have no way to license someone. That's just the process that we have. There are 15 different specialties. If you're looking for a generalist to evaluate the structural competence of a building, then you want to have someone who's competent in that area of engineering. So it's not the same as just licensing someone who isn't knowledgeable or an expert in that area. I think you have to be cognizant that there are so many different types of engineering, and one is not interchangeable with the other. I also caution the legislature that when you create new and broader discretion to the boards, the process may result, and I'm not saying it does, but it may result in an issue such as a recent case that went up to the U.S. Supreme Court, Board of Dental Examiners versus the Federal Trade Commission in 2015. I don't know if you're aware, it's the dental licensing board in North Carolina. Because they were given so much discretion and they were not under the direction of the legislature, they waived their immunity for the antitrust activities, so they had some issues there. And I just caution when you're making changes that you be cognizant of some of these other exposures. It is within my job duties to review and monitor compliance with various state licensing laws. Each state's rules vary greatly. However, waiving both the fundamental and practical exams would not be helpful to the state of Oregon, so I oppose the bill and urge the committee to oppose this bill. Thank you.
Welcome.
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, and the rest of the members of the committee. I'm Paul Heidenreich. I am here as a member of ACEC this afternoon, and I really just want to expand on this a little bit from my own personal experience. I am registered in three countries. I am registered in South Africa, where I obtained my degree, my civil engineering degree, through an accredited university, and got registered as a professional engineer by going through the process that is required over there, which is slightly different from here. I then moved to Canada, where I'm also registered as a civil engineer in the province of Alberta, went through their process to get my registration. When I moved to Oregon, I had 19 years of engineering experience, and I applied and was told, sorry, the rule is we want to make sure that even though we can see that you have an accredited university degree, that's acceptable to us, we still want to know that you can practice as a civil engineer. And I wrote both of those exams. I just said, fine, I'll write the exams. I went through the process, wrote the exams, got myself registered as a professional engineer to do business in Oregon. I've also have a professional registration in the state of Washington because the firm that I work for, we do work in Washington as well. We actually do work all over the states, but I'm not working in other states, so I had no need to get those registrations as well, which I can obtain if I go through the process. For instance, if I wanted to work in California, I would have to write additional exams, even though the basic exams that I have written here are compliant. California has additional requirements that I would have to work with, and that's not a matter of, gee, do you have 25 years or 30 years of experience? That is, we want to see and be sure that you can do the work as is required by your profession in our state. And so if I wanted to do that, I would do that. And so, therefore, I do not see any real difficulty with anybody from Canada or, for that matter, from any other country wanting to obtain their professional registration in Oregon by being in compliant with the requirements. In other words, we need to write the fundamentals of engineering and we need to provide the engineering exam to make sure that that person, that individual, meets the requirements that the board has for professional practice in the state. So, I mean, you know, the one thing that I would say, the fundamentals there and the statute at the moment, I mean, the statutes at the moment allow, that's the 25 years, that gives the board the ability to waive the requirements for the exam. It doesn't say that they waive the exam, that they waive the requirements for the practice, engineering practice or PE exam, but they can waive the exam for fundamentals in engineering. And fundamentals engineering is basically a basic exam that typically gets written by students right after they graduate from an engineering school. And so that I just want to add that, and that for that reason I'm opposed to the bill as well, because I see no reason that people who want to register here just can't go through the process. It's fairly straightforward and simple, in my opinion.
Thank you. Senator?
Yep. Maybe you could tell me what's wrong with reciprocity, because that's the fundamental thing that we're looking at. Now, when I became a dentist, we had reciprocity with a few states. Nevada, we did not. Nevada, no matter who you were, you didn't pass unless you were from Nevada. They wanted to keep people out. And later on, just a few years ago, they waived it also that anybody could come to Nevada because they didn't have enough dentists. So I I mean, I like I said, I practiced in Canada. I think if somebody went to McGill, got a degree in engineering, they probably would have a leg up over some of the engineers that we create locally. So I understand Marshall's point, the $62 engineering license in Bolivia, but I don't see that as being, you know, somewhere near equal. So
right.
if you had and it's something that would be comparable with what we had, and if, you know, say, and I think reciprocity should go across the states too. So it could be a degree from UCLA, a degree from McGill, or a degree from Oregon State. To me, as long as you have a degree and you've demonstrated and passed an exam in your local area, then I don't understand what's wrong with reciprocity, because, quite frankly, I like it.
Right. No, and I completely agree. I have no objection to reciprocity. And right now, NCEES, you mentioned them, right? They basically, you can sign up with them, do their exam, which is basically the same exam that you would do in any state, pretty much. And then you would have reciprocity in most of the states in the U.S. Like I said, there are some of them that have some additional requirements, and that is because they believe they have additional. California, for instance, they're saying if you want to practice here, you need to understand the issues around seismicity, around seismic. So in California, there's an exam for seismic, for specifically to test you on your knowledge about seismic. So I can understand that. That's very important to them, and their board has decided they want that additional requirement. But for most states, it's simply a matter of reciprocity. For instance, when I applied for my PE registration in Washington, I filled out the forms. It was signed by my supervisor and saying, yes, he's worked for us, he's done this, he's got the experience, and here is the proof from the examining board. I passed the exams, and I got it through reciprocity. So I have no concerns about reciprocity. I think the issue that needs to be, and Aaron raised that, is to make sure that the quality of that education is there, that it meets the same requirements that we expect from our own engineers to practice, and that we can say, yes, this is for the welfare and safety of the public, and that is completely acceptable.
And I think what you're saying is that you take that test once and you can use it.
Right.
Yeah.
That is correct.
Yeah.
I would just like to add something else. When I practiced in Canada, there was a shortage of dentists, and so I was taught in America from the Hill here. A lot of people were taught from UBC of British Columbia. We had people from England. And the thing is, there are subtleties that were different.
Right.
But the irony of it is that by amalgamating all the subtleties, I think you really got a more rounded practice out of it, because your school wasn't all right. I mean, it's just,
right,
there are things that just you were out of the mainstream, and it just, some of it didn't work. So that's another reason I really like reciprocity. So thanks for your testimony.
Mr. Chair, Senator Girard, just one last point. The proponents of the bill talked about catastrophic situations, and so that's one of the reasons we're here, is to learn about what the bill is really focused on. If it's catastrophic situations, the big tsunami going to hit Coos Bay and the North Coast, we're incredibly concerned about that, and there are situations and there's a process in place for that right now.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Let's see. Next up I have, looks like, Matthew Cash and Dale Bowder. Welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon, committee members, Mr. Chair. My name is Matthew Cash. I'm the president of the Professional Engineers of Oregon, and we represent over 5,000 engineers licensed here in Oregon, as well as over 10,000 engineers that reside elsewhere but are licensed in Oregon. And I'm here to testify against Senate Bill 885 as it's written. We have some concerns, most of which have already been discussed. But I wanted to also let you know of our willingness to work with the legislature, if you would like, to offer amendments. And we have been working with the Pacific Northwest Economic Region, and we've been discussing the amendments, which hopefully would address some of these concerns with them. So, thank you.
Thank you. Sir?
Yes.
going to have to read some of my notes.
Perfectly fine.
Sorry for the lack of some of the eye contact, but thank you, Chairman Beyer and committee. Listening to this, there's been about three different issues that have come up.
Can I just put your name on the record, please?
Oh, my name is Dale Bowder.
Thank you.
Yes. There's about three issues that have come up before I get to my notes, and one is that this bill is really not, it's been waived as a Canadian issue, but it's not so stated in the bill, and that you've mentioned so well. It also has been waived as a bill that deals this emergency situation, and that is not language that's in the bill. And there is a process that I'm pretty sure it does not require a engineer to assess the qualifications to tag the buildings as to whether they're interable or I think there's three levels or maybe more of caution condition of buildings after a major earthquake or catastrophe. I don't believe that it's an engineer specifically that has to do that. There's building codes people, there's other people as well. I worked at Oregon State University in facilities, and there was people in facilities that could do that that weren't engineers. In current law, OSBELs can already, per 672.103, as I would very loosely paraphrase, allow someone outside Oregon who merely has some kind of authorization elsewhere to do what they call engineering there, not a requirement to actually have performed engineering elsewhere, to have comity to be allowed to do engineering here in Oregon. However, currently, OSBELs cannot do so unless the person has, quote, previously passed a practical engineer's examination approved by the board, end quote. There's also a 25-year requirement, but it's not a requirement for experience. It's a requirement for having held the authority to do engineering. If you'll read the law finally, that's what it says. It isn't experience. Note the current law does not actually require any experience for OSBELs to use examination waiver 672.103. Current law merely requires a person to, quote, have held a registration or license to practice, end quote, not necessarily have actually practiced engineering. The bill seems to be making two changes, one reducing the required period from 25 to 8 years of having held a registration or license to practice before allowing OSBELs to exercise the examination by waiver process. And number two, the bill is to removing the requirement, quote, of having previously passed a practical engineer's examination approved by the board, end quote. In order for them to exercise the waiver method. Both of these are lessening of requirements, the level of which currently does not allow OSBELs to exercise examination by waiver for some persons. This law has to do with the allowance. It's on OSBELs, what OSBELs can do. Adoption would allow persons currently not considered qualified for registration to present lesser than existing qualifications to OSBELs as evidence of acceptable qualification for registration, about which OSBELs could consider and grant registration. Adoption would allow OSBELs at its discretion to register people who have neither a fundamentals or practical examination if they're somewhere else have been authorized for at least 8 years to do engineering there, even if they haven't actually done any engineering there. That had to do with that $65 license, I think, that I heard about before. I'm not sure
which change would be responsible for more additional registrants. It seems like the pool of potential users, they might go hand in hand for many. In other words, people needing to use both provisions of the changes would probably be the same people. I don't know. So the question seems to be whether or not to leave these requirements in the law outside the discretion of OSBELS, or to revise the law and give OSBELS discretion over the area of loosened requirements. Do we want obeyance of existing law concerning it, or do we want OSBELS to have discretion over it? I don't like the idea of OSBELS being able to allow someone who hasn't had even 8 years required experience in practicing engineering to do so here in Oregon by so little as a paper process. I don't believe that's in the interest of the people of Oregon. And there's a lot of misunderstanding about thinking that this is experience, this 8 and 25 years. The law, current law, doesn't require that as an experience, merely holding a license. And I don't think it's, I just don't believe that this is in the interest of the people of Oregon. That's it.
Thank you very much. Questions?
Yeah, I have one, Senator? For the president of the association.
Yes, sir.
It just would seem to me like the engineers in Oregon would want to have the ability to practice in Canada or England and allow them to be here. I'm not trying to lessen the qualifications.
Right.
I want highly qualified people, but it just, you know, I always thought it was nice that I could practice in different places, and I made use of that. So, I mean, you're not opposed to reciprocity. You just don't want to lower the standards, if that seems to be more what I'm hearing.
That's right. So I happen to be, for the record, I live and work in Salem, but I happen to be licensed in 23 states and Canada. There is some level of reciprocity now, depending on the province. Our concern would be just what you said, not lowering the requirements. So experience, testing and accreditation, education experience, and ethics, as well as making sure there is equivalency amongst those things that Oregon engineers now have to achieve. So, yeah, thank you.
Okay, anybody else? Thank you very much. That's all I have signed up. Does anybody else wish to testify on this bill? Seeing none, we will close public hearing on Senate Bill 885, and we will reopen on Senate Bill 989. Patrick, you got that list again?
Oh, yes, I do. Mr. Chair, I do have that list. There's our three folks.
All
right there.
Nancy
D'Souza, Scott. Nancy
D'Souza?
Scott Nebaker.
Scott, huh?
Nebaker.
Nebaker.
And Paul.
And Paul. Get you all three at once. Because I'm sure you all have exactly the same opinion. Welcome.
Thank you. Chair Beyer and members of the committee, Nancy D'Souza, Executive Director of the Travel Information Council. And I'm going to be really brief at Patrick's urging today. I know you're running late. Essentially, what we want to say is that the Travel Information Council is highly honored by Senator Boquist's vote of confidence in our ability to manage the rest areas around the state. The bill, as originally submitted, is extensive, and we've been working with our partners at Parks and ODOT on which ones really fit the model of a full-service rest area around the state, particularly in key travel corridors that would be the most appropriate to fit our model, which is staffed and well-maintained at a level that is beyond the scope of what Parks and ODOT has been able to do within their funding. As we said in our presentation to you a couple weeks ago at the overview, our model is more expensive, so gleaning that number down to those that make the most sense. Ultimately, it will be the decision of the legislature as to how those are going to be funded, but we have staff working behind the scenes now to develop that final list that we would propose that we're in agreement upon and what it would cost to fund those and then get that to you to determine. So we respectfully request more time to come to you before this bill has worked, but we do commit to getting it to you as soon as possible, which won't be too long.
Well, I appreciate that, but I guess the question I would ask you is, I understand your current model. Mm-hmm. We've been talking about this for a few years now, but I like the work that you're doing and wonder if maybe there's room for a couple of different models in terms of the level of support in doing that. Would like you to think about that. I don't expect an answer, but just something to think about there. Because I know ODOT has sort of a different opinion of rest areas in terms of the priority of schemes. Paul and I have talked about this before. Sir.
Chair Byer, members of the committee, Scott Nebaker with Oregon Parks and Recreation Department. I will be very brief in my comments as well, simply here to confirm our previous involvement in discussions with Oregon Travel and ODOT, and that we look forward to continuing those discussions to try and find appropriate resolution.
Thank you. Paul?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Member of the committee, Paul Mather, Highway Division Administrator. I've provided some written testimony. I'm really here just to help answer questions, but also just in the conversation we've had so far, a reminder, you know, it's a matter of priority. We've got, you heard me talk a number of times about bridges and seismics and pavements and everything else. Rest areas are important too, and people want good service at rest areas. It's just, it's, we got resources and priorities. So we're working with our partners, and as Nancy said, working to bring something back to you.
Thank you, Paul. Questions? Don't see any. Thank you very much. I appreciate your working on this, and we'll look forward to hearing back again.
Thank you, sir.
Okay. Thank you. Is there anybody else who wishes to address Senate Bill 989? Seeing none, we will close public hearing on that, and we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 333.
Ready for it, Mr. Chair?
All right.
Senate Bill 333 removes loan forgiveness and reimbursement delays and makes other changes to the industrial site readiness program. Take effect on the 91st day following adjournment, sine die. We have before us the Dash 4 amendment received last Friday. I will, in the interest of time, Mr. Chair, turn that over to Andy to talk to him.
There's a misprint.
Welcome.
It should be removes the barriers to loan forgiveness.
Who wants to start?
I'll start with Senator Byer.
Thank you.
Members of the committee, my name is Catherine Williams with the Port of Portland, here today to talk about Senate Bill 333 and the Dash 4 amendments. Senate Bill 333 makes some procedural changes to Oregon Industrial Site Readiness Program by removing loan forgiveness and reimbursement delays. Tweaks to this program will help the state increase the number of market-ready industrial sites for traded sector developments. A little bit of background. We know that industrial employers looking for land have quick timelines tied to their investment decisions and manufacturing cycles, making it hard for them to commit to sites with significant constraints or uncertainties. The availability of market-ready industrial sites is a key asset for areas hoping to expand or attract traded sector jobs. Many regions of the state lack an adequate supply of such sites. Even when sites are zoned, planned, and designated for future industrial jobs, significant capital investment like infrastructure, brownfield cleanup, wetland mitigation, and site aggregation may be required to make them market ready. Many local jurisdictions are unable to afford these investments or are unwilling to incur significant upfront costs without some level of risk and/or reward sharing. The unrealized state economic benefit from successful traded sector development, these are direct and indirect jobs, income, and property tax revenues, is significant. In fact, the state's general fund would be the largest beneficiary from an increase in traded sector industrial jobs and growth in income tax revenue. I'm going to turn it over to Andy Shaw with Metro to describe the bill and the Dash 4 amendments in more detail.
So I am Andy Shaw with Metro. Back in 2013, the coalition of governments that are supporting industrial land readiness worked to enact Senate Bill 246, which is this program. The current program, as was mentioned, offers partially forgivable loans or reimbursement for project costs to public sponsors. So this is helping the local governments who have made public improvements to make these lands more attractive, finding a way to help share that that cost. But the program remains unfunded. So while we have continued to seek funding for the program, the various partners in this coalition have identified some technical changes that would make the program more streamlined and allow a better system for reporting out of the data. These changes included having the Employment Development Department provide job and wage reporting rather than the end employer who ends up on one of these sites. because they really had no role in the investments that were made, and so would have no incentive to necessarily provide that data. It would enhance the opportunity for local jurisdictions across Oregon, particularly in rural Oregon, to take advantage of the program by modifying the wage threshold requirements. And in recognition that the state is the primary long-term beneficiary of jobs and investments resulting from investments in these sites, it would allow local sponsors to begin recovering a portion of their site readiness investments the full tax year after jobs are created on the site. It also makes some clarifications about Oregon Business Development Department and DAS responsibilities. We've worked closely with some of the state agencies in crafting these changes. Now I'll turn it over to Rocky.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, Rocky Dahl, I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Economic Development Association. OEDA is a coalition of economic development professionals around the state, both private and public sector, and OEDA has helped coordinate this coalition on industrial site readiness going back as far as 2011. The staff's prepared a really good summary going back to Senate Bill 766 in 2011, and then in 2013 with Senate Bill 246 establishing the Oregon Industrial Site Readiness Program. Throughout that time, our coalition's been broad and diverse, including the Oregon Business Council, the Oregon Business Association, Association of Oregon Counties, League of Oregon Cities, the Oregon Public Ports Association, utilities such as Portland General Electric, Thousand Friends of Oregon have helped out, and some of our private regional economic development agencies. It's really been a broad coalition of folks within the metro area and outside who've recognized the needs that both Catherine and Andy have talked about. So, what we're asking here is that we make the changes to the program. I would acknowledge, as we've talked with a few of you and appreciate the patience putting together these amendments, is that we are not asking for funding this session. We haven't received it yet, and we recognize the challenges and think this is an opportunity to improve the statute and answer some of the questions that we've had over the last couple of sessions. So we think that these technical amendments are a good addition to the bill, and hopefully you guys will pass it and happy to answer any questions that we can. So thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions? Don't see any. Thank you.
I said I like the idea.
Okay. Jody Weisner and Marcia Kelly?
I think it's the people that don't like the idea.
Welcome.
Thank you. Speaking for Taxpayers of Oregon, I'm Jody Weiser. So I want to jump to the last line of my testimony, because shovel-ready properties is not a concept we have any problem with. It makes sense that a business would like to come and find the roads and the streets and the sewer and the electricity available at their sites. The problem we have is with shovel-ready for free. Recently, a business bought some of that land in Portland for $170,000 an acre for a distribution center. If you're building houses, you pay $600,000 an acre for land, and it doesn't have any roads yet. The cost of those roads and the sewer lines and everything is in the price of the house that you buy. Includes all the infrastructure within that development. And yet when we're selling land to businesses, we're asking school children to pay for the cost of the infrastructure. It doesn't really make sense that we treat two different kinds of development so differently. Further, we have some issues with other parts of the bill that weren't mentioned by the proponents. It removes the requirement that compensation be good compensation. Actually, the current requirement is quite weak. The current requirement, which starts at the bottom of page one of the bill, says that it must provide full-time jobs that pay in total compensation, so that includes all benefits, at least 100% of the county or state average wage, whichever is less. We believe that that should actually be changed to the 150% of the county average wage, or you're not getting necessarily good jobs. When the Secretary of State's office did their analysis of some of the business programs that like this, what they found is that the pay on some of our enterprise zones was actually less than the county average wage. So we're subsidizing worse than average jobs, not better than average jobs, and yet thinking that the general fund should return half of the income taxes of the employees to the local community to pay for the street sidewalks and et cetera for the development of industrial land. So we would say keep that sentence in and drop the line, whichever is less, just say 150% of the county wage. That's the only way you're going to get jobs that actually pay well. In Washington County, under the current law, you could pay total compensation of $76,000 when the average compensation in that county is $100,000. So that's not what we're supposed to be incenting. Not just any old job, but good jobs. So we would make that change. And further, this is an opportunity for you to reconsider the whole idea of gain share. Should we really be returning 50% of the income taxes of the employees of a facility to the preparation of the land that those people work on, or should the businesses themselves be paying that instead? The idea that we would give loans and get paid back over time makes sense. Every community doesn't have money to do that, but the fact that we're being asked to actually subsidize that until 100% of the cost is repaid is part of why we don't have enough money at the state level, and part of why we are judged as the state with the lowest business taxes in the nation.
Chair Byer and members of the committee, I'm Marcia Kelly, public policy advocate for the Oregon Women's Rights Coalition. Some of the concerns that I have about the bill is in talking about the need for industrial lands. If you look on the Business Oregon website, you will see that they have 27 site-ready lands. This bill seems to concentrate on the metro area, and I know that just down the freeway there are two areas in Salem that would fill those capacities, and they've been sitting there. It's if you're trying to incent jobs in rural and semi-rural Oregon, it's not going to help to keep on incentivizing metro area lands. And so I think that it would be a good idea to look at what's available and what sorts of things you're doing to incent rural Oregon jobs versus metro area jobs, because it's my understanding that our unemployment rate is now at 4% in Oregon. It's not, and that's an average for Oregon, and there are rural areas that have unemployment higher than that.
Thank you. Questions? A senator?
Yeah, I actually was going to follow up on what she said, because Jody, when you said that you have to have a 150% of the county average, Mill City, Oregon, right now is they ran a test, and the average salary up there is 60% of the average in Portland. And so if you got a job, if you got something that was even close to the county average, they would be jumping for joy in rural Oregon. I mean, it's just totally different.
And another thing, the current law benefits the urban areas. It hurts the rural.
Well, it doesn't. But if you want to put stipulations in there, the jobs have to be 150%. That really hurts them, because no one's going to go there. That's what I'm saying.
Well, but that's compensation, not wage. It's 150%. The total compensation, so that includes all your benefits, has to be 150% of the county average wage. So if the wage is 60, the benefits are going to be 25%.
No, I'm not talking 60,000. I'm talking as a percent. They make
about 60% of what they make in Portland.
That's right.
Yeah.
So, I mean, so most rural Oregon is that way. So we have to attract businesses, and so we have to have shovel-ready properties, and we have to be prepared to do that. Another thing, just for me, I wish you would drop the lowest business tax idea, because that includes a sales tax. If you want to say, because we don't have a sales tax, business taxes are the lowest tax. I can buy off on that. But it's not actually true, when because most people don't consider a sales tax a business tax.
But business and businesses, as you know, do pay sales tax. They do in business to business transactions. So it is definitely why our taxes are on business are low. I agree.
Okay.
Good.
Done?
I'm good.
Okay. Thank you very much, ladies. That's all I had that signed up on this bill. Is there anybody else who wishes to discuss Senate Bill 333? Seeing none, we will close public hearing on 333. We'll open public hearing on Senate Bill 936. Patrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 936 sets incremental increases in the taxable portion of the value of eligible project property under the Strategic Investment Program and eliminates the difference in taxation of projects in urban and rural areas. It increases the cap on the community service fee from $2 million to $2.5 million and eliminates the $500,000 cap for projects in rural areas. The measure has a effective date of the 91st day following adjournment sine die. We also have two amendments. The Dash 1 amendments modifies taxable portions real market value for eligible projects and in $100 million for projects in non-rural areas or in rural areas, $25 million for projects up to $500 million, $50 million for projects up to $1 billion, and $100 million for projects with a total cost exceeding $1 billion. We also have a separate Dash 2 amendment that clarifies that projects determined eligible under ORS 285C600 to 635 on or before February 1st, 2017, are subject to taxation under ORS 307-123. No paperwork on any of these amendments, Mr. Chair. They're relatively new. So.
Same old, same old. Welcome, Doris.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Doris. Excuse me, I've had a cold, so let's keep our fingers crossed.
You're far enough away.
Yes, I will. Doris Penwell, I represent the Association of Oregon Counties, and I am here in support of Senate Bill 936 as amended by the proposed Dash 1 amendments. We want to thank Senator Johnson for working with some of the county commissioners on the issues that they have been dealing with over the past few years. As you know, the Strategic Investment Program began as an urban, as a program for all of Oregon, but it really only affected at least one company, if not just a couple more. But after a few years of successful operation, the legislature instituted the rural portion of the Strategic Investment Program. But when they did that, they had lower thresholds of capping of the total amount that needed to, that property taxes were paid on, and they also had much lower level of a required community service fee each year on the project. Well, since we've had these rural sections of the statute, we've had a number of very good development projects in rural Oregon, and frankly, they have ranged from $108 million to almost almost $100 million, or a billion. A number of especially renewable energy development projects. As we began negotiating these projects and moved along, it was clear to a number of the county commissioners that we really were shortchanging ourselves if we didn't propose that we have sort of a threshold of investments where taxes were paid and community service fees were to be instituted, depending on the amount of investment that you made. The original bill, when it was drafted, it included both urban and rural thresholds. And frankly, that wasn't our intent. Our intent was what we proposed in the Dash 1 amendment for the threshold levels, just for rural portions of the state. So this bill would not affect investments such as Intel and future investments for them. That's for another conversation. And we've had a lot of great investment, but well, as I said, we just didn't feel that we were getting what we should from the rather large investments that were being made. We have recently had one investment in Gillum County that would if we did not amend this bill, could be caught in the bill as it is affected if it were just the original bill. So the Dash 1 amendment actually takes care of that issue, too, so that this bill would not be in effect until after July 1 for any approvals by the Oregon Business Development Department. I'd be happy to answer any questions. It's kind of confusing going between the original bill and the Dash 1 amendments, but what we like is the whole bill with the amendments to Dash 1.
Questions,
May
Doris?
May I answer some questions?
Don't see any.
Thank you, Doris.
Okay. I've worked with a lot of the parties that may be affected by this bill, and hopefully we've taken care of the issues that they might have.
All righty. Okay.
Briefly, Mr. Chairman, Alan Tressiter representing Avangrid Renewables. I just wanted to say you have Dash 2 amendments before you. You no longer need those. Worked with the counties and others, and the Dash 1 amendments take care of the amendment I needed to make to the bill. And so everything's taken care of inside of the Dash 1 amendments.
So everybody's happy with the Dash 1?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jim Craven for Intel. Yes.
Yes. Okay.
Yes.
I think the full bill, though, Senate Bill 936, in with the Dash 1 amendment is what we would propose that you have, because okay. The original bill had the community service fee escalation in there as well.
All righty.
Which we'd like to also go with if you approve.
Any questions? Senator Riley?
So this is about SIPs, is that?
Yes, it is.
And how does this affect gain share?
Mr. Chair, Senator Riley, I believe it doesn't affect gain share at all. In the 2015 long session, after a lot of conversation, this body came up with its solution to the gain share program, put a cap on it for essentially for Washington County, $17 million, I think was the number. This bill will not affect that resolution in any way.
Thank you very much. And Jody and Marcia.
Thank you.
Welcome again.
Thank you.
It is insane. It was meant to be my phone.
For the record, Jody Weiser for Tax Fairness Oregon. I'll avoid that point for sure. I have not seen the amendments, so I'm not sure how much what I have to say is related to the Dash 1 amendment that the proponents are pushing. The first, my first concern, and it sounds like maybe it's addressed in the Dash 1, is we should not be having the same requirements for rural and urban Oregon, because the intention was to entice smaller companies to rural Oregon for their investments of $25 million that would get this tax break. That same investment in an urban area wouldn't get the tax break. And in fact, I think it was in 2015 that you voted to make sure that the rural SIP was no longer used in an urban area as it was for Genentech. But my real concern is with the new tax proposal, and not that we shouldn't be receiving more from the wind farms and from Intel and Genentech, but this is a stepped program that is so uneven. So if you look at step C on line 17, a facility would pay the taxes on the same $150 million, whether their original cost was $1 billion or $2.5 billion. So they would be paying taxes at 6% or 15% of their property. That's a really broad range. And why wouldn't you just do something that was simpler, like saying you would pay taxes on 10% of your investment, your original investment? It seems like that's just as logical and fairer, because you're not going to have this really uneven up and down depending upon where you are in the investment and how much you've invested. I mean, it would be strange to have to pay taxes on a lot more property because you spent an extra $100 on a $700 million facility. But that's what the current idea would do. And so I would suggest that you just change it so that the new tax is on 10% of their original investment. And then my second concern is, it is true that we've had the SIP since 1993, and the community service fee has been $2 million since then. But if you go to a CPI calculator and you calculate the current value of $2 million, you would need to raise it to $3.4 million to be giving the local communities the same amount that they would have gotten in 1993. So it seems like that would be the correct number to use rather than $2.5 million. Let's raise it to a really indexed number. And finally, you know, with all of these programs, so we give away property taxes, we're giving away 41% of the money is education dollars. And there's a community service fee that is a nod to, you've given up a lot of tax money. It would make sense that we would have a state service fee for the same amount so that there is at least a nod to the state. You've put a lot of money into this because you've given up all those K-12 and ESD dollars. And if they don't want to recognize that, that's one thing, but then maybe we stop allowing those taxes to be abated, just abate the local taxes. Thank you.
Jody, I would point out, though, keep in mind that this program is a voluntary program on the part of the local governments. They don't have to offer it. It's voluntary. And they are free to negotiate other things.
Right, and they often do actually negotiate higher local fees, but they don't negotiate higher for the state. And yet they're abating the education dollars that are otherwise backfilled by the state. And so that's what I'm speaking to. They're making a decision to give up K-12 money that goes to every kid in the state.
Chair Beyer and members of the committee, I'm Marcia Kelly from the Oregon Women's Rights Coalition. Just a couple of points. Jody's said most of my points. However, on the community service fee, she not only thinks we should index it to the current CPI, I would suggest that you put a CPI in if you're going to continue this program. Some of the concerns that I have as we note that renewable energy programs are big investments. Oftentimes, however, those renewable energy programs only have the jobs associated with while they're being built, and they have very few continuing jobs. So in rural areas where the land is less desirable, it's maybe that's a good place to put big projects, but should we be continuing to give away the tax dollars for few jobs after the construction? The same points, kids' school, every dollar you give away in property tax abatement means money out of the state for education to make up for the property taxes deferred.
Okay, questions? Don't see any. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And is there anybody else who wishes to comment on Senate Bill 936? Seeing none, we will close public hearing on Senate Bill 936. Note for the record that we will carry over Senate Bill 867 to the 29th, our next meeting. And the rest of these we will reschedule when we have the paperwork. And is there anything else for today? There is none. We are adjourned.